Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
I'll tell you about it offline.
All right.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined today by Ezra Klein for another debate wrap-up. Ezra is also on today's episode of Today Explained, an excellent podcast that you could listen to today and every day. I think also doing debate takes there, but we're going to be a little more weedsier.
Yeah, we're talking about Elizabeth Warren's frontrunner status over there.
Yeah, see, that's like the politics headline news, you know. This is The Weeds. We're going to get into the deep cuts.
Yeah, we got one more quick plug though. So this weekend, I'm starting for my sins a new podcast called Impeachment Explained, which is about digging into some of the deeper questions of impeachment, like what does high crimes and misdemeanors mean, and like what role does Fox News and conservative media play in changing this from how it was for Nixon, or like what can we learn from the Andrew Johnson impeachment? There's so much kind of torrent of news about impeachment, but there's a lot of these deeper issues that are going to shape it. So we're going to be digging into that every Saturday on Impeachment Explained. We'll sort of do a news wrap up and then, you know, really get into the guts of it. And so I think we listeners will be into it. And you can subscribe now wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss an episode.
That sounds fantastic. So last night, we heard a lot of kind of stuff that we'd heard in debates previously. But something new that happened was Erin Burnett asked about automation. And she, I think, somewhat mischaracterized Bernie Sanders' jobs guarantee as a solution to automation. But that then got a bunch of different candidates to kind of weigh in on the general subject. And, you know, most of them, I think, really heavily bought into the sort of key premise that automation is driving job losses. Andrew Yang used the kind of like techie guy catchphrase, the fourth industrial revolution. But then like all the way at the other end of the like conventional politician spectrum, Joe Biden also used that exact same catchphrase. And, you know, and that goes to show that like there is a real
huge victory for Eric Brynjolfsson and McAfee.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a big nexus, right, of like, you know, like big think people, TED Talk kind of guys, technology industry people, and like big time DC politicians who are thinking around this. Elizabeth Warren made a sort of hyper-specific dissent, which was she said that manufacturing job losses had more to do with trade than with automation, where I think the AP fact checker said she's wrong about that. I think that depending on what time frame you're looking at, she's right if you're talking about very, very recently, although wrong if you're talking about the longer spectrum. But like more broadly, I would just have like rejected the premise of this, that there's a big surge of automation.
I want to separate out a couple threads of this. So one, I think we need to talk about productivity, right? Because the place you would actually see this happening is productivity growth speeding up or accelerating in some fundamental way, which is to say, are we being able to make more stuff with fewer people in the economy at a higher rate than we were before? And you've done a lot of work on that, and we'll talk about that. I had Andrew Yang on my podcast like a year and a half ago, and we had a long argument on this. And I like Andrew Yang, and I think he's actually been a great entrant in the Democratic primary. And I don't think he actually is all that convincing on this point. But let's bracket productivity. Mm-hmm. But the other thing then is that there's this question of when you're talking about what automation is doing to jobs, because it's not doing nothing. are you talking about net job losses? So what's happening to the economy overall?
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about that there is some job loss that even if the economy overall is managing it, the people who are getting hurt are not managing it? Are you making an argument about future job loss, which was happening last night on stage? Like, we're going to come up with self-driving trucks and what's going to happen to all the truckers? Are you talking about wages? Mm-hmm. And are you talking, or, and then there's this whole like other thing about dignity, right? Are people feeling less dignity in their jobs and getting angry about that? And so I also want to talk about the idea of, is UBI, even if you buy all of it, is UBI a good solution to this problem?
Right.
But why don't we start with productivity? Because I think that this is pretty poorly understood and that you have a more clear view of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, look, you look at statistics, productivity, it's like the dollar value of stuff produced per hour worked. And it's been going up. It goes up almost every year, which is a kind of nice coincidence about the world, right? We do make progress on becoming more economically productive. But we have been making progress at a slower rate over the past 10 years. Than we did previously. And not just the United States, right? But you see this in essentially all developed countries. There's been a big slowdown in productivity growth. And even the pre-recession productivity growth was slower than what we saw in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. So, you know, if you judge by productivity terms, right, the true heyday of automation came in the years after World War II, when we did not have what we would call robots or artificial intelligence, but we did have lots and lots of kinds of new machines that were being rolled out at a very rapid pace, oftentimes because scientists had come up with stuff during the Great Depression, but they didn't use it because the economy was so fucked, or then scientists came up with stuff during World War II, but it was like only used to kill Germans. And then it sort of got unleashed on the United States and on Western Europe. We had very rapid productivity growth. And of course, people don't remember that as like a time when, oh, woe is me, like all these jobs were wiped out by this new technology. What happened was is that average annual hours worked went down a lot. Wages went up a lot. People started retiring when they got old. And it was nice. And we kind of just think of that as the good times. In the present day, we've had a sort of much rougher economic experience. And, you know, again, if you think about it, if you step back from this rhetoric about automation, you think about things normal people struggle with. Like, a robot won't build you a house. A robot's not going to watch your kids. If you get sick, you can't go to a robot doctor, right? There have been these sort of marginal changes in how you schedule appointments. But in terms of like the core housing, transportation, and caring services that dominate household budgets, we've made actually really, really, really little progress. We've had totally dramatic technological transformations of essentially entertainment, right, and media, like the industry you and I work in. And that looms very large, I think, in media discussions of the world. But for like most people's lives, the problem is the opposite of like a relentless pace of change. It's that we're not getting any better at the stuff that soaks up money and crushes people's living standards.
And so to pull out, I think, a couple of the objections you'll hear in this, it is true that there are certain service sector roles that people really believe have been automated away. The example that Barack Obama always used was bank tellers, mm-hmm. because we got ATMs.
Right.
But very famously, while it is true that we got ATMs and that like probably has automated away a lot of bank teller jobs, there are more bank tellers today than there were in the 70s.
Yep.
And that's probably because ATMs has made banking more efficient, which led to them like putting branches everywhere and just made the banking industry a lot bigger. Now, maybe compared to some other world, there would have been more bank tellers, but I think that it is hard to look back on that as some kind of hit to the economy. That's clearly not what happened. It's not even clear it's really hit bank tellers all that hard. So that's one thing that I think is worth noting there. The other thing that comes up a lot in this space is something called mismeasurement theory.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an argument that we are mismeasuring productivity. We're not correctly applying the gains of productivity because, you know, maybe the productivity gains we're seeing are not well priced into the economy because everything is, you know, free, but you're doing advertising, or you get different versions of this argument. And I've looked into this quite extensively and like wrote a long piece about it a couple years back. There's been a lot of economic research on this, and it just does not appear to be true. So it is true that we never measure productivity fully correctly. There's a huge amount of gains that are never priced into the new innovations, consumer surplus gains and other things. What you need to believe for that argument to be true is that that is happening more now than it was before. So that there is more unpriced or unmeasured surplus from, say, like my smartphone, which I think kind of like on net makes my life somewhat worse, even though I can't imagine a way of living without it, than there were for antibiotics, for toilets, for electricity,
right,
for roads, for cars, right? All these things also automated away other things. I mean, when we were able to power things electrically, a lot of folks who moved things from place to place under their own power, like, lost that job. But as you said, we don't think about that period in American life as bad for the economy. Similarly, you can look at what has happened to agricultural labor. It used to be that a huge proportion, I think at the very least north of 40% and possibly quite a bit higher than that at the dawn of the country, was employed on farms. Now fewer than 2% were, and we make a lot more food. But because that happened relatively slowly, we have more than absorb that into the economy. And obviously, we all think that the American economy is better today than it was in, you know, the late 1700s. And so when you're even looking into that forward question of what's going to happen with self-driving cars and some of these other innovations that are on the horizon, the question is really how fast they happen. And I do not see any likelihood that we're going to have self-driving trucks that do not have a person in them soon. I feel like all of my reporting on this, just like, people believe it might even be technologically possible. The idea that the regulations are going to permit it just seems very unlikely to me. So I don't think the story really holds up. There are a lot of problems in the economy, and I'm not saying automation isn't hurting people, because it is hurting specific people, but it's very hard to tell any macro story that fits the data or our own past that is convincing here.
Yeah, and that's where I want to distinguish, as you said, right? So, like, individual people are always being harmed by different kinds of technological changes, right? That's something that has been true for, like, a couple centuries now. And I think that's really important, right? I mean, if you want to think about what is a problem in American society, it's not a new problem, but a problem is that people, you know, they go to school, they get a job, they work for 5, 10, 15 years, they develop a lot of specialized skills, right? So by the time you're in your late 30s, your mid 40s, you have both an income and a status that is higher and different than what you had when you were 19, right? You are a professional, you have mastered a trade. And then sometimes technological change comes along and it just kicks the feet out from under you, right? So if you think about, not like quote-unquote robots, right? But like, there used to be people who ran camera stores, or you would develop film, right? And these were like, you know, jobs. They weren't like the most elite professions, but it was not unskilled work. This was stuff people had invested their time and their energy in. And then digital cameras come, and then smartphones come, and that all goes away, right? My mom was an analog page designer. She had like blocks of metal type and little knives and all kinds of rubber paste. And then Quark Express, Adobe PageMaker come along, and that's gone, right? And so like, in a humane society, you have both a welfare state that, you know, insulates people against these like ups and downs of bad luck. And I think you should also try to cultivate a culture that does not like excessively admire people who happen to have gotten into lucrative fields of work, right? There's like both a material and a spiritual element of acknowledging that like we are buffeted by these forces that are beyond our control, right? When Democrats were talking about this, they weren't like talking about that, right? They weren't talking about like, how do we use progressive politics to like be fair and decent in a world where change happens? It was instead like, automation is this thing, right? This like discrete thing that is either happening now. Julian Castro said like, well, you see these automated checkout kiosks at CVS, which you do, right? But you also see plenty of people with low-wage retail jobs, right? Like, that has not gone away. And it just seems much more pressing to me to address the like first order questions of systematic economic risk, or just people who do jobs that don't pay very well. Like, they work at the CVS, right? And they are glad to have that job. They would be upset if it all went away, was replaced by self-checkout. But so far, like, it hasn't been, right? And mostly what happens is people open more stores now that stores are less labor intensive, which is fine. That's like the economy functioning. But like, you know, people like, they need better pay, they need more control over their schedules. It just struck me as like a very frustratingly science fiction-y conversation, right? And like weirdly detached from everything else they'd been saying all night about how like healthcare matters or unions or whatever else. Because the reason all that stuff matters is that technology changes and we should want it to change more rapidly, right? Like, we should want to have progress, and then we should want to have policies that, you know, facilitate progress and make it bearable.
So I want to make a slightly weird argument here.
All right.
I think that, one, everything you just said is true and I agree with it. But I think that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren actually have a better response to the automation challenges in some ways than Andrew Yang actually does. And the reason I say that is that what has happened in a lot of the jobs we are talking about that are declining? So, for instance, Sears isn't around anymore, but Amazon is. And so fewer people work at Sears, which had like actually a pretty good culture of how it treated its employees, but a lot more work at Amazon warehouses. Mm-hmm. And there's not been the time put in and like the organizing and the long effort to make the jobs in Amazon warehouses well-paid, good benefits. Like there's starting to be some of that. And actually, Bernie Sanders has really pushed hard on that. But there is a thing where the jobs that are getting created are in many cases not as good as the jobs that are getting destroyed. And the way automation is structuring things and globalization, like there's a whole debate between Warren and Yang about whether it's trade or it's automation, which I think it could just be both. But it is leading to the people who own capital just making a lot more money. And so like the distribution of gains is quite off. And again, I think like Sanders is very focused and Warren to a lesser but still real extent, very focused on moving that distribution around. Andrew Yang's big idea is the freedom dividend, which is functionally a universal basic income of about $1,000 a month. And I have become, over the past couple of years, much friendlier to UBI as something that maybe is just the way we should structure a more decent society. It gives people more choice. I think it gives workers arguably somewhat more power. But Dylan Matthews has written a great piece on UBI a couple of years ago, and he makes a point, particularly around the automation conversation, that UBI both does too much and too little here. Mm-hmm. UBI goes to a huge, I mean, the vast majority of the public whose jobs are not getting automated away. So you're spending all that money, if you're trying to solve automation, giving money to people whose jobs are totally fine and are the same job they had last year and maybe the same they had 5 years ago. And on the other hand, if you really were a Teamster who lost your truck driving job because of self-driving trucks, and you're making $70,000 with benefits,
right,
and now you get a $12,000 a year UBI, and you don't have the dignity of that job, and you don't have the money of that job, well, you actually didn't solve that guy's problem at all. That guy is going to be furious, and his life is going to be much worse. And so you've managed to have a very poorly targeted policy for the automation problem, whereas I think a lot of the redistribution arguments and worker power arguments, like sectoral bargaining and co-determination and things like that, in terms of what automation is actually doing, which is concentrating a lot of the gains at the top of the income brackets and then taking away a lot of worker power. Like, mm-hmm. That's a really good way to try to attack those questions, no matter whether they're happening from automation, from trade, or just because of the way the economy is changing and norms within it are changing.
It's weird because like the UBI thing, it's so big, right? But there's actually like a very small problem in American life that has turned a lot of politics around on this, which is that, you know, there's a sort of unresolved question in America, or we had one resolution to it in the 1990s, and it's, are unmarried mothers who don't have jobs worthy of social assistance, right? Because if we give social assistance to unmarried mothers who don't have jobs, and you can call that a child allowance, you can call it a UBI, you could call it a means-tested welfare program, right? There's a lot of different ways you could structure it, but that is a group of people, right? Households that are headed by non-working, non-married mothers has an extremely high poverty rate, right? Like, so child poverty in the United States is off the charts, and it's because we don't give financial support to households that have that structure. And the reason we don't do that is there's a moralized sense and a racialized sense that these are bad people. That, you know, it's great to give help to seniors or to veterans or to the disabled, but that if you've got, you know, if you don't have a husband and you don't have a job, you shouldn't be having children, right? And like, UBI is so much bigger than that, but if you look at like what good would UBI do, so much of the good it would accomplish is by lifting up that group of people who are really suffering economically by a refusal to do it. And it's the same with, you know, Democrats have this less grandiose American Family Act in the Senate, which is a child allowance. It's sort of UBI for kids or UBI for parents of kids. And it does an enormous amount. It would cut child poverty by 50%. But again, the main reason it does that is it would reverse the decision made in welfare reform and say, we are going to give money to this very objectively needy group of people, even though they defy somebody's sense of like bourgeois morality. Like, that's a really important question in American politics, right? Like, our decision to not support unworking single mothers gives us some real outliers in social problems and social statistics. And to discuss that issue sort of under the lens of, well, we're talking about automation or something, I think it's very misleading, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can kind of frame the question or structure the program or target the benefits. But the core question is like, are we willing to say that this is part of our national community? And like, I think we should, right? But like, that's the dialogue to have, I think, not like our robots taking over, but like, do we care or are we going to go back to, you know, Ronald Reagan complaining about welfare queens?
But this is actually the distinction that I've come to believe about UBI. I think almost every argument that frames, and I've like been at the center of a lot of UBI argumentation. My wife, Annie Lowry, wrote a great book on UBI called Give People Money. Dylan, who I've worked with for like 15 years, has been like on UBI the whole time. I've like been around a lot of UBI people through the two of them. And I think almost every argument which posits UBI as the answer to an acute problem, like the one you just laid out, like we don't support single mothers, is a bad argument. Automation, there's always a more targeted way to solve the acute problem you're trying to solve. On the other hand, the utopian arguments for UBI, that maybe the way we should structure society is to say that no matter what, no matter who you are, no matter like how you construct your life, you should have enough money to not be in poverty so you don't have to work. And we're not going to judge you for that, right? It is part of a cultural view that in a super advanced society in the year 2019 or 2025 or whenever we're talking about doing this, you can actually just stay home and enjoy your leisure and not have that much money, but you won't starve and you get healthcare and, you know, whatever else a basket is. I think that like might be right. I think that might be like a more radical but correct way to think about society. And I don't just think that on single mothers, right? You know, UBI would also attach to just people who do care work but don't have time or are doing a job, right? Somebody who's left the labor force but is caring for elderly parents, right? That's valuable work and is like involved in their community. Maybe they should be compensated at least at some level. There's a good argument to be made that a UBI is a way of instantiating a different hierarchy of value and a different way of saying what does it mean to be born into a rich country than what we've said before. Like, I am pretty sympathetic to that. But yes, like as soon as you get into, we have this one problem, like automation, and we're going to solve it through UBI, like immediately you realize UBI is extremely poorly targeted and an unbelievably expensive and controversial way of solving a problem that could be solved much more directly and affordably by other means.
All right, let's take a break and then let's talk about the other end of the spectrum here and what's happening at the high end.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So it was not my expectation going into last night that a lot of the really interesting arguments would be an Elizabeth Warren-Andrew Yang matchup. Like that wasn't on my like scorecard, but
know.
It actually was true. So we had the UBI and like where are the job losses coming from. But there's another debate between the two of them in which Warren has been arguing for a wealth tax, a 2% tax on wealth above, I believe it's $50 million. Mm-hmm. And Bernie Sanders has also brought out a wealth tax that is actually in some ways now more ambitious. But Warren has really made this the core of her candidacy. Like 2 cents on the dollar, she like has this laundry list of things it can pay for. And like that just shows like what her values are about how to change the economy. Yang made the point at the debate that this wouldn't work, that other countries have had a wealth tax. They found it very, very hard to administer. And so they've mainly moved away from it and moved towards value added taxes, which is not exactly like how I would think about that transition. But he's not wrong that they've moved away from wealth taxes. And he's not wrong that a lot of economists believe a wealth tax would be quite hard to administer. Like, how do you value a painting, for instance? It's like mm-hmm. a good question in that. But you've done some work here. So I'm curious how you rate the wealth tax and implementation debate.
I find some forms of this discussion to be a little bit in bad faith, right? Like, it is true that there is a specific challenge about how will you value wealthy people's art collections. But like, it's also not true that art collections are a major component of people's financial wealth. When you think about implementation problems here that other countries have faced, the core implementation problem that historically bedeviled wealth taxes is tracking the ownership of financial assets, right? It's not that like German people had some super secret kind of wealth, right? It's that they would actually hide their wealth. You know, if you go all the way back, right, thousands of years, the history of taxation, if you read James Scott's book, Against the Grain, he talks about what made wheat cultivation so special. And what made it so special is that it was really feasible for a pre-technological society to tax. You could show up at people's wheat fields at harvest time, and either they were there standing by all their wheat and you could demand they give you some of it, or they would run away to escape the tax collector, and then you could take their wheat. And other agricultural commodities weren't like that. They were much harder to tax, right? And so, but we evolved over time and developed systems to tax land, to tax real estate, because you can't like hide your house someplace. But it was very hard to tax financial assets, right? Stocks and bonds used to be like literal pieces of paper. You really could hide that from the government, and it was challenging to tax. I think in the modern world, we have developed the tools to track and tax financial wealth in the United States. And if you watch the discourse around the Treasury Department is going to impose new sanctions on various Russian entities, how can they do that? And the reason they can sanction foreigners is that we can track modern banking transactions. Everything is electronic thanks to anti-money laundering laws, thanks to the post-9/11 crackdown on terrorism. We have just much more insight into what is going on with people's wealth. The old Swiss banking regimes have been really sort of undermined, and we happen to tolerate corporate tax dodging in the Cayman Islands and the Bahamas and places like that. We allow people to establish sort of fake corporate headquarters. But if you think about international politics for like a minute, if the United States of America wanted the Cayman Islands to knock it off and like not allow thousands of companies to register like a fake shell address in one office building, like we could make them stop. We aren't doing that because we don't want to. It's a policy choice. But so Switzerland has a wealth tax. It's small. It's lower than Warren's wealth tax. But it works fine. They, you know, don't have any problem tracking people's financial wealth. And then what's true is that they have these marginal problems, right? Like, what if somebody cashes in all their stocks and chooses to invest it all in second-tier Monet paintings? I don't know, you know, but everything is like that, right? Like, we have sales tax, but it's hard to perfectly monitor taxes on cash transactions. A house painter, you know, told me he would knock a little off my bill if I paid him in cash. I didn't know if he was trying to cheat on taxes or trying to cheat on some immigration rules, but like it was something, right? And so that happens, but we don't say, oh, income tax doesn't work because some people hide their cash income. We don't say sales tax doesn't work because some people underreport. Wealth tax, like, it should work fine. The question is really, how do you value privately held companies like Koch Industries, right? That's sort of the one thing that's in the middle, where it's not most wealth, but it's, you know, more than zero. And, you know, that's hard, but it's not impossible. Like, privately held companies do deals with each other.
Yeah, it's clearly not impossible. And one thing that I think often gets underplayed in this is that you could have a wealth tax with a reasonably high avoidance level and just raise a lot of money. Right. It may be that you just accept that and some economists did a study looking at exactly this question, that if you model this kind of tax and you assume a 15% successful avoidance rate, which would be quite high, you've raised billions and billions and billions of dollars for what you want to do. I'm not super concerned about one, like, rich people moving away. That's just probably not going to happen. And if you are a rich person and you've decided to like leave the country because of the taxes, I don't know. Like, my kind of view is good riddance to you. And two, I'm not super concerned about like everybody stocking their money in paintings that are harder to value because, again, like, people want assets. And the thing about being rich at the kind of levels Elizabeth Warren is talking about here, $50 million in wealth, is you're really rich. Like, you are really rich. Like, you are rich enough. I mean, we are way beyond the like viral financial diary about how it's hard to be middle class in San Francisco on $350,000 a year. Like, you are rich in a way that there is almost no lifestyle you cannot afford without not noticing it. It may be that some people have such like an ideological objection to the taxation is theft of my wealth. And so like they run around. But for most people, they're not going to notice. At these very high levels, a lot of the money being made and kept is scorekeeping, right? It shows your value. You're in competition with other people. It's a positional ranking of where you stand in super elite society. But it's not like you can't eat if you're losing 2 cents on the dollar of your assets over $50 million. I don't know. Beto O'Rourke popped into the debate and, if I'm remembering the quote right, called it punitive.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was shocking, actually. Wealth inequality is like an incredibly real thing. And if you've managed to amass $50 million, you can give back more. Like, you can. Like, it's fine. That wealth is worth very little to you. I think you've made the point many times, Matt, that in some ways, like, the best argument for these much higher levels of taxation is the incredible declining marginal utility of the dollar people have. That at that point, that dollar just means nothing to you. And if everybody's getting it taxed away, then the positional question of it is reduced as well. This is a big argument Robert Frank, the economist at Cornell, makes. And so, like, we should do that. I'm not saying we should like tax all of it away. And we can talk about Bernie Sanders' wealth plan, which at very high levels like goes up to an extremely high marginal tax rate. But nevertheless, it's not punitive. It's about trying to like build a fairer society. And my God, if this society was so good to you that you paid $50 million in wealth, which was clearly not just you, like that is a lot of other things happening and going right and a lot of luck aligning in the right way. Yeah, like you can pay some of it back. That's not punitive. I was pretty annoyed at that Beto O'Rourke comment.
To defend Beto, I don't know. I think if you try to say punitive, but like in a non-judgmental way, it's relevant to this, right? Because I do think one question, stepping back to like Yang's point about the VAT or like Larry Summers has been on this crusade specifically about the enforceability and the collection ratios, which I think is more his personal beef with Elizabeth Warren than anything else. But I will say that it depends a little bit, like, what are we trying to achieve here, right? If the feeling is the government needs a lot of revenue on an ongoing basis to fund a new program, right? I don't think the wealth tax is a super compelling way to do that. So like Warren will like to rattle off like this raises so much money that we can do like her childcare thing and like seven other things, right? But if you think about this in the long term, right, like how is American society going to work? The clear structure and, in fact, purpose of this wealth tax is to drain, like, the bank accounts of the hyper-wealthy, right? Because, like, 2 cents on the dollar, right, like, that's not so much. But over a 50-year time span, it's actually a lot, right? And because you know that the wealth is going to be taxed, it also encourages you at the margin to spend it faster, to give it away faster, and basically to, like, dissipate your fortune, right, on some mixture of paying the tax, doing charitable contributions, and just, like, spending money on stuff, right? I don't think that's a crazy idea, right? But the concern is that you will have generational dynastic wealth, and the wealth tax is supposed to break that up. Incidentally, it raises a lot of revenue, but I almost think, like, conceptually, it would make more sense to take that revenue and just give it to people blindly, like per the UBI, because it's really just like a party, right? Like, we are saying these tech gazillionaires plus the Walmart heirs and a couple finance guys, like, they just amass these unconscionable fortunes in a second gilded age, and now we're going to, like, ransack their storehouses, give the money away to everybody, and then reset with, like, a new, fairer economy. Whereas, you know, if you look at a standard European welfare state, you know, Sweden, whatever, they have income taxes and they have value-added taxes, and they're just high because people keep having incomes and they keep buying stuff at the store year in and year out. And then those high taxes pay for social services. So, like, if you go shopping in Copenhagen, you'll find that everything is, like, terrifyingly expensive because of the value-added tax. But then if you, like, want to go to college or get your kid to a preschool, it's super-duper cheap compared to America, medical care. So, you know, that's a different way of, like, restructuring how things work on a day-to-day basis. So in that sense, like, I do think it's punitive, as Beto said, right? Like, the idea is that the wealth itself is somehow bad, right? And that we need to have a leveling impulse on society. And I sympathize with that, but I also sometimes don't. I don't know. You know, this is, like, one of these things where, like, I see the debate going, and I kind of feel differently on different days. Like, is it bad as such that, like, the hyper wealthy have so much unrealized capital gains and we should do something about it? Or is the issue really that, like, we just, like, we need some programs and then we should fund them in whatever is the administratively simplest way?
Recognizing that we're in a bit of a semantic argument here, I would say that the reason I don't like the term punitive is that I think it is taking something where we are like making an argument about how to structure society and mm-hmm. adding a very value-rich term to it. So we're going to go and talk about Warren and the Medicare taxes in a minute. But I think something that is very notable is that when Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or anybody talk about raising middle-class taxes to pay for something like Medicare for All, Warren doesn't quite admit that's what she's talking about, but it is what she's talking about. Like, nobody thinks that is punitive. They think it is like a structural position, and that it would be a better that, like, from behind the veil of ignorance, like, we believe mm-hmm. whoever is saying this, that it would be a better way to structure society. And similarly, there's a thing where a lot of these billionaires are signing the giving pledge or promising in some way or another to give away a vast amount of their wealth before they die, as opposed to passing it down to their children. I think Warren Buffett has said he's going to give away almost everything. I think the Zuckerberg chans have said they're going to give away almost everything. Bill Gates is clearly giving away, like, most of his fortune, or at least, like, they're planning to do this, or say they're planning to do this. And I don't think that's them being, like, punitive to their children. I think it's, like, a view about, like, what is a good way to build society, including, by the way, for their children, because I think often the children of super rich people don't turn out that well because, you know, they don't have like, it's weird to just, like, never have to work for anything. So I don't know. I take your point, but I think that it is one of the ways discourse has been distorted, that there's become this view that to structure society such that we don't have just endless accumulation of wealth or, like, endless run-ups in income, when you begin talking about those upper-level taxation questions, people see that as a real laying down your values on them mm-hmm. as opposed to you're trying to structure society, and this is one of the questions you have to face. Now, by the way, it's not the case that nobody ever acts punitively in it. Warren was getting accused of this, but I actually think Warren talks about wealth a lot less punitively than Bernie Sanders, who clearly believes, like, the accumulation of these kinds of fortunes margins is immoral, and we'll kind of say that a little bit more forthrightly. But you can really separate that out. The question of whether or not you're doing this because, like a robot, you just think this would be a better way to structure society, or like a socialist, you think rich people are immoral and like either should be taxed or should go under the guillotine. Like those are like, you can choose that, but you can have the kind of value neutral version of this. And I think you see it when we talk about things like Medicare taxes.
Yes. All right. Let's take a break. Talk about the Medicare tax.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Journalists really want Elizabeth Warren to say that her vision of Medicare for all involves higher taxes on the middle class. And Elizabeth Warren clearly really doesn't want to say that, even though I think everybody on both sides of that question knows that it's true. And on some level, it's a little hard to say what the stakes are, because she's not saying it isn't true. She's just wants to characterize it differently. And I don't really know what do you think this amounts to?
So just the backdrop of this is that early on, in the right after the impeachment section of the debate, Elizabeth Warren got asked about this. She gave her sort of normal answer, which is that you should look at total cost, right? The connection of premiums and taxes and everything, and the total cost for middle class families under her plan, which is at this point just Bernie Sanders' plan, will go down. And then Pete Buttigieg, who was like having a much fierier night, like really went at her on this, and they went back and forth for a while. And then Amy Klobuchar got involved and everything. I think there are a couple stakes to this debate that are interesting. So one stake is that I do not think it's a good look for politicians to be seen like hiding the ball in a way that is clear that that is what they are doing. Because like people are going to estimate this plan. They are going to, like they've done this already. I think the accepted estimates are that the Bernie Sanders plan would mean about 30 some trillion in spending on the federal budget over a 10-year timeframe, which is very, very, very large. As a comparison, Obamacare in its totality was about $2 trillion in a 10-year timeframe. Now, that will mean that a lot of private sector costs are coming on to the public sector. And then there's a bunch of other questions about how do they do pricing and other things, and how much is actually included in the benefit. Like right now, they would bring Medicare pricing over. They would, like, the benefit would be everything, which we don't really know how that would change utilization. It could drive it way up. So it might actually not be cheaper overall. But you can imagine ways of doing it that it would be cheaper overall. But it's very hard to say who would be the winners and losers if you don't have the financing set up. So That's kind of the policy question that I think Warren is trying not to answer. And in particular, is like not dealing with the issue of how are people going to react when they don't really know how much their employer is paying for their care right now, but all of a sudden they have to pay a higher tax for the thing their employer had before. I think the one place that this actually does have a real stake in it, though, Bernie Sanders, who's very committed to this set of ideas, Medicare for All, and the sort of broader universe of redistributive ideas he's pushing, he clearly believes that if you're going to get a European-style welfare state in America, you're going to have to convince Americans to pay for a European-style welfare state. And you're going to have to like neuter the attack or stop believing the attack that taxes can never be seen as like the price we pay for a good society. And Elizabeth Warren does not hold to that view. But in the kind of ongoing like Bernie supporter backlash against Warren, which I don't want to like overgeneralize it, but is certainly happening among like extremely online Bernie supporters, I think there's a sense, and I think it is a correct sense, that one of the differences here is that like Elizabeth Warren is probably not going to spend all of her capital on a Medicare for All fight. And that's part of why she is not setting up a more winnable argument for herself or like setting about this in the way that like protects her from later on like a CBO score. Whereas Bernie Sanders like really would like gamble everything on Medicare for All. And that is part of the reason like he is starting out by saying like, yes, taxes are going to go up. You're going to hear that. I have told you that from the beginning. And so I think in that prioritization question, which is a very important question, you are seeing a real difference between them that is not fake, but is also, to be fair, not like explicitly being drawn out on that stage. The final thing I'll just say is that the other stake is that I think Klobuchar, Buttigieg, Biden, the rest of them think that this is a real weakness for a Democrat in a general election, and they want to prove that in the primary and convince people to move over to them for electability reasons because they're not promising these kinds of tax increases, but they can't quite convince Democrats of that, even though I think there's a good chance it's true.
There is clearly like an important Warren Sanders battle over this, even though they don't disagree, right? Where like essentially what's happened is that Bernie, by being in the race, is like pinning down Warren's left flank, right? So she can't just say what – people forget this, right? But Barack Obama, John Kerry, Al Gore, they all agreed in principle that a single-payer healthcare system would be a good idea. And then they said they didn't think it was politically tenable and they were going to work on some more short-term intermediate options. If Bernie Sanders becomes president, it's still going to be the case that single-payer healthcare system is not politically tenable. Like just ask Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bennett, Kamala Harris, like all these senators he's running against, they're not for it. So what he's going to do is like have to do a legislative negotiating process and accomplish something more interim, right? So like on one level, nothing has changed. On another level, everything has changed, right? Thanks to Bernie Sanders. And so now Warren can't do that. She can't do the single payer makes a lot of sense, but here's my plan for prescription drugs. She has to keep saying, oh, she's going to fight for single payer. But she's also like a practically minded person. So she's terrified of these tax attacks. So she's like up there bobbing and weaving. But I think she actually did a really good job of making this into a purely semantic argument about costs versus taxes. Because here's my question for her, if I could nail her down on this, is like, is it true that middle-class families would see lower total costs? Because if that is true, you should be able to write down a plan with numbers in it, specifying what the tax rates are. And then, you know, she knows lots of smart college professors, so does Bernie Sanders, right? They should be able to show, look, families of this type will save this much money. And I'm not sure that it is true because one of the things they're doing, they're not just proposing that we swap out the existing insurance and have government-provided insurance, right? That would save money, right? If instead of private insurance, we all had a government plan, I think there's a lot of ways that that could bring costs down. And then if you use progressive taxes, you could save most people money. But they are promising to replace our private insurance plans with plans that are much more robust, right, that have no deductibles, no copayments, things like that. That really drives the price tag up. And it solves a big problem. Like, one of the big selling points of Medicare for All, if you listen to either Sanders or Warren, is that right now they say that a lot of people are underinsured, right? That people who have insurance still face devastating financial impacts of illness, or they don't go to see medical professionals because they are successfully deterred by deductibles and copayments. And they want to replace, like, the typical American's insurance with some much more robust insurance. And so that is definitely good for you if you have a lot of medical costs, right? Like, that's what they talk about, that, like, there are all these stories of people who are sick and they need to see doctors and they're not getting enough care, and under Medicare for All, they would. But there's also a large number of people who, like, don't have a lot of medical costs and who I think would probably be at least narrowly financially worse off under a system where everyone got a more generous insurance that they then don't actually take much advantage of. And, like, I could be wrong. I mean, I'm open to it, but I sometimes needle Lori Kearns about this on Twitter. She's on Bernie's team. But it's like, if this plan is so good, like, I'm convinced by the broad numbers on national health expenditures and administrative costs that, like, you quote unquote could write a plan that made the vast majority of people better off, but they don't seem to have actually done it. And I think the reason they haven't done it is the insistence on the zero copayments, which has not been the focal point of debate, but it increases the bill for this, like, a lot, and not always for reasons that are being articulated very clearly, because they don't have an alternate plan for rationing care. And it's, like, a little bit, on one level, like, I don't care because this is all fantasy land and it's not going to become law. But I think if you were really to, like, get into the weeds on Medicare for All, like, that's the question, is why do we have this commitment to literally zero cost sharing, which isn't how they do it in Europe. It is how they do it in Canada, but I think it causes a lot of problems in Canada, like, including the fact that they don't cover dental and they don't cover prescription drugs, like, which is crazy. If you cover anything, it should be prescription drugs. That I think is the thing. Like, Warren does herself a favor if she can kick this into the terrain of pure semantics. And, like, it's just not obvious to me that it's true that typical families will see costs go down.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way you need to think about this, and one, by the way, we should note, like, there's typical families and then there's, like, your family. And even in 2016, when Bernie Sanders was running, something that came out, and they've tweaked the plan since then to try to deal with this a little bit better. But it came out, and I think this was in an analysis by Ken Thorpe, but it was going to hurt a lot of Medicaid users right now. Because of the way the plan was structured, they would actually turn out worse off. Like, most people would be better off, but some of the poorest of the poor were going to be worse off. And they've, like, made some changes to that, and I'm not saying it's true now. I've not seen an update on that estimate. But the details of this really matter. The details of how you do the financing really matter, because what was happening there was a lot of these Medicaid users were paying nothing. But if you assumed, you know, one of the kind of more broad-based taxes that Sanders has the Times talked about, they would be paying something. So they would be actually worse off. Another version here, what you're talking about, is if you have a plan that covers everything with no point of care financing whatsoever, no copays, no deductibles, no nothing, what does it do to utilization? I think in most models, it will drive utilization way up. It's not going to drive it endlessly up because most people don't like going to the doctor, but it will drive it up.
And it's intended to drive it up. I mean, I just think that's an important point.
And I think, like, I've talked with Matt Brunig about it and others, and there's a hope. There's some research out there that basically says, well, look, like, when you add this kind of coverage expansion, what's going to happen is not just that the people drive more, but that hospitals and doctors and others, in order to triage their volume, they just stop recommending so much unnecessary care, which is basically you're going to take care away from richer people, and hopefully that care is not that useful in order to spend more time caring for more people. That may be true to some degree. I doubt it's true to the entire degree of a coverage expansion this size. But basically, in terms of how you're going to pay for this, what CBO decides is true there is incredibly important. And then you have this other thing of, what do they decide is true in terms of, like, the pricing power, adding Medicare pricing with, like, some rural exceptions probably, and the administrative cost savings. And, like, all that is, like, really important. And the more detailed you get in the plan, like, the more you're going to have to deal with it. But it'll really, really shape. You could have something where 54% of people are winners and 46% of people are losers. But 46% of people is actually a lot of people. Or even if it's 70-30, 30% of the country is a lot of people. And so, like, this stuff gets really hard. I will make the one other point, that there's a funny way in which Andrew Yang is arguing for a tax structure that is sort of more like what you would expect from the Warren and Bernie like social program visions. And like Warren and Bernie are arguing for a tax structure is a little bit more like what you would expect from like the Andrew Yang dystopic, like what's going to happen is that everything will move to automation and only the people who own the robots will have any money. So like taxing their wealth would become really important. There's like a funny swapping of the plans that you could imagine happening here that would be quite, I think, useful for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like a broad-based VAT, like Andrew Yang describes, to finance a universal healthcare system, that's like a classic thing. Like lots of countries do that. It seems to save money overall. It is more fair. It would not make 100% of people better off, but it, I think, would be better for most people. It's just a little politically unpalatable for various reasons because people don't like taxes. But then, yeah, as you say, right, like if you were Warren's plan, Bernie's plan, like soak the rich with like super high taxes on the super wealthy seems like an answer to this other kind of cosmic crisis. I never know what the Medicare for All debate is like about at this point in time, right? Because so much of it seems to me to actually not be a debate about organizing American healthcare, but just a debate about Bernie Sanders, you know? So like people who 5 years ago were like happy to say that in principle a single-payer healthcare system was a good idea, but like who don't like Bernie Sanders are like now mad that he's campaigning on it. And people who really like Bernie Sanders like want to talk all the time about Medicare for All and what a great idea it is in principle and show very little interest in like working through the specific problems in the way that you would think you would want to. And that's not to, you know, cascade like every single person involved in this. Like if you talk to like the Physicians for National Healthcare Plan, right? Those guys have been pushing for single-payer healthcare forever, since as long as I've been in the industry. And they have these like incredibly detailed blueprints for how everything works. And that's because like they are really in it because they really strongly believe in this idea of like big bang transformation of the American healthcare sector. So they are ready to give you chapter and verse on how all these things work. They will tell you that like, yes, we're biting some bullets on this or that or the other thing, but like it's worth it. It's important. But like this dialogue that's happening in the primary, we're on to like the fifth year of Bernie running for president, right? And I think like the points he makes about this are all correct. And then also most of the questions critics raise are also correct, and he's not like answering those questions. And why should he answer them? Because it's not a real legislative debate.
I think it is a real debate, but I think you're right to say it's not the debate they're pretending to have. Mm-hmm. I think this is a debate. And I've like now spent a lot of time debating people in it, and it took me some time to see what we were actually arguing about. It is a debate about politics and how it works and like what makes things pass and what keeps them from passing and what makes people win elections and what keeps them from winning elections. And I would say that at a very core level, the argument that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are making is actually not a policy argument, but an electability argument. And the counter argument is actually not a policy argument, but an electability argument. And the electability argument they are making is that what will make you electable is a set of inspiring, unbelievably ambitious visions where you can really tell people what they are going to win out of it, like what they're going to get, like how like politics will make their life dramatically better all at once, and that will mobilize your base. And the key thing to winning election in the late 2010s is mobilizing that base. And a lot of people with you can say maybe a more traditional view of politics, you could say a experience of politics that is not in like the two bluest states in America. Their view is that, yes, you need to tell people what you're going to do for them, but you also need to be sensitive to their concerns about what you will do to them. And to have something hanging out there like tens of trillions of dollars in tax increases, or I'm going to take away the health insurance you like and rely on for some government plan that like you don't really maybe trust and like you don't maybe trust me, is going to be electoral poison. And so they're having this argument about Medicare, but I think the reason they're not having the argument like we are talking about, like, well, what should we have co-pays or not? Like, that's an interesting question. Let's debate it. On a policy level, is that the reason it focuses on abolishing private health insurance and taxation, in addition to that being like what moderators who want to see a fight ask about, is that that's actually the way they're getting at this political electability argument of like does what you're promising outweigh the attacks it opens you up to? Or do the attacks you are opening up to outweigh what you're promising? And because like the proximate goal is to win the election, the fact that like none of this will pass is actually not all that relevant, at least not yet. Because like once somebody wins an election, then you can try to figure out how to pass the maximum amount that you can possibly pass. But before then, the question is like, how do you win an election? And like there's a strong view that compromising down beforehand is like not the way to do it. And then like a similarly strong view that freaking people out is not the way you do it. And like it's just very different implicit views of the American electorate.
But so I think this is not going to be me diagnosing what other people are talking about. But to me, what has like gone, what I would like to see done differently in the future from how politics was done in the past is not what you do during the election or even what you do during the legislating phase. It's what do you do after that? Right? Because what happened with Obama and the ACA is that like Obama started out saying like, yeah, you know, like in some level, like single payer, that's fine, but we need to be more realistic. I have this plan. He puts out this proposal. It has a public option in it. The public option is watered down and then it's stripped out. Some other elements of it get changed and to an extent weakened as it goes through the congressional ringer. Then the Supreme Court knocks out like a really big piece of it. With Medicaid expansion, also like the experts start saying like almost right away that the mandate as written is not strong enough to achieve its real goal. And then HHS starts writing the regulations around the mandate deliberately to be kind of weak to minimize political backlash. And like that's all fine, right? But what happens the day after that is not that Barack Obama says all the things he said during the campaign about like how tragic it is that people go uninsured in America, about how we need to take on the special interests, about how we need to provide people with an adequate standard of care. Instead, what happens is you go into this kind of like spin mode where it's like this outcome of the legislative process that did not get the things they were asking for. Like it's all great. Like it's fantastic. We're moving on. We're done with healthcare. And I was there. So like I know why that's what they did. And then you have like some of the people who were involved in writing the bill like go off and work as industry lobbyists and stuff like that. And that's the kind of thing that I think causes people to lose faith, right? And to like the idea of a crusading politician who, you know, like Bernie Sanders has voted for a million like incrementalist healthcare bills over the course of his career, right? But I think like what's cool about him is that he always keeps saying that he thinks it's morally outrageous to live in a society where there are people who for financial reasons can't get the medical care that they need, right? And like the fundamental promise that is interesting to me in this is to like not give up, right? Not to like just go native and be like, hey, I'm amazing. I did these achievements. But to like keep saying that the structure of society is unjust until it has become just. And that is not like – it's not like a policy question. In a lot of ways, I think these sort of like clever Buttigieg, Beto kind of like halfway Medicare things, like they make a lot more sense policy-wise and politically. But I respect and I feel the yearning for someone who's not going to let like legislative reality then like set their own moral horizons, but who's going to keep saying like what they believe in.
Yeah, I think that is completely what this is about on some level. I think it's probably a good place to end though too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, what we are all about here on The Weeds is policy, politics, all that kind of stuff. Send us an email, weeds@vox.com, if you've got any thoughts, suggestions for, you know, other aspects of the debate you might like us to weigh in on. Thanks so much, Ezra, for joining us from the West Coast.
And check out Today Explained, which is doing a lot of awesome stuff lately, but we have a fascinating conversation about Elizabeth Warren today.
There you go. So, you know, I want to thank, as always, our sponsors. I want to thank Deb Edidel for engineering this episode and our editor, Jackson Bierfeldt. And The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.